for the incredible sound of classic rock. No, good, because now it's time for Visiting the Village.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to episode 54 of Visiting the Village, the gaming show which focuses purely on banality. With me as ever is the immutable Ian Hardingham.
We're late in charge. Let's go.
Absolutely. Yes, filming myself from a new angle today, including the ominous mirror in the corner. I hope you enjoy that. Now, today's top story is the Pirate Bay promoting an indie game. It's McPixel, the famously quirky point-and-click adventure. What happens is when you go to the Pirate Bay's main site now, you get a giant link for McPixel, which points you to a pay-what-you-want page for a limited time only. Ian Hardingham, do you think this should be happening?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. You know, a lot of the people going to the Pirate Bay like games, and a lot of them would not go to a person's website and buy a game in general. And I like the idea of it linking to a pay what you want page, because obviously a lot of people will just pay nothing, but some people will pay something. Apparently he made $134 in the first few hours that was going on, which doesn't seem very much, but I guess it's better than nothing.
Yep.
It's pretty crazy. I mean, I guess there are moral issues if you don't agree with piracy, and the Pirate Bay is sort of illegal or whatever that means in an awful lot of countries. I think it's kind of cool, though. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing I might consider doing after my game had been on sale for 10 years or something.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting because it marks such a paradigm shift, almost literally, for the Pirate Bay, which is a kind of acknowledgement that, you know, people might want to be paid for something occasionally and they might want to make revenue from the games that they're making. So if pay what you want is a payment, you know, structure and a business model that people who only pirate things now think is acceptable, then that could be a really positive move in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to be clear. Like, I don't think we're commenting on the morality of the Pirate Bay in general. I think it's a pretty dodgy area. I'm not sure I like the idea of these guys profiting from giving links to other things people are getting for free. But I mean, from a purely business point of view, this is probably just a win. You know, you've got a vast number of eyeballs on this site every single day, and they like games, and they may give you some money. So I think it's really creative. I really like it. I mean, I'd be interested to see if he had any backlash in the community. There are a lot of people don't like piracy and don't like the Pirate Bay. I'd be interested if people think that it's sort of doing a deal with the devil, for instance.
Yeah.
I'd like to know that.
I certainly think that there are some people who definitely believe that, you know, who just believe. I think there are some people on some end of the spectrum who, you know, believe that all of these torrent sites are just completely wrong and that there is no moral grey area whatsoever. And, you know, given that, yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of... The statement is quite complex. It's like, this is a site where you come to get stuff for free that, you know, you would otherwise pay for, but here is a thing that you can pay for. It's definitely interesting. I mean, and of course, there is the positive aspect of those sorts of sites where they're distributing, you know, genuinely free content and they're providing a means to do that. So if they're now distributing genuinely paid for content and providing a means to pay for it, then I can only see that as a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like some arguments for legalizing drugs. You know, that people say people are going to use drugs no matter what the truth of the matter is. And if you have a place where it is legal, then it's going to be a safer thing to do. It's going to be a lot of advantage of that. I'm not saying whether I agree or don't agree with that argument,
yep, yep.
But I could see some arguments for the Pirate Bay. You know, if it's also trying to get some people to pay for things as well, then that's sort of probably better than not doing that. But again, it's so difficult. The whole piracy issue is something which everyone has a completely different point of view on. I in general think that if someone genuinely can't afford to play my game, you know, if someone's monthly wage is significantly less than my game costs, I don't necessarily have a problem with them pirating it. I mean, those people... them, if they never would have played your game to start with and they play it, that can be some good things for you. So I don't know if I would ever do a deal with Pirate Bay, though. I think it's probably too underground.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff in the chat just pointed out, interestingly, that McPixel was one of the first 10 games to be accepted onto Steam via Greenlight. So he's basically kind of, the dev is taking every one of these like modern zeitgeist opportunities and kind of embracing them. And I just think like, I have sympathy for that. Like, I have real sympathy with if you're pushing sort of one of your earlier titles. I mean, I know this guy's made a lot of games beforehand, but maybe your first sort of more mass market title, just to take every opportunity you can find out there is certainly an interesting approach, but then you inevitably get into some moral conflicts and weird stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people, a lot of very big companies are kind of, let me bring out the air quotes, taking advantage of piracy with free to play. I think free to play is where people are really saying, okay, let's give these guys what they want and get them into our space, you know, not the Pirate Bay space, our space, so we can start selling things to them if they ever feel like buying anything. So we're definitely finding ways of leveraging a phenomenon which clearly isn't going to go away just because Ubisoft require to connect to a server.
Absolutely. Second story today is Blizzard watermarking screenshots. Now, I believe this was broken on Slashdot, and the issue here is that when screenshots were taken from World of Warcraft using an internal screenshotting tool, there was secure information embedded within the file, including things like the username of characters who had older accounts, the user ID, Blizzard's internal ID for newer accounts, and the server and the server's IP address. Ian Holding, what do you make of this?
I'd just like to start off by saying how bizarre the idea of something breaking on Slashdot is. Anyone listening who actually uses Slashdot knows that they're usually about 2 days late with anything. So breaking a story immediately made me think that it wasn't true. And I've looked into it, and there seems to be definitely some argument about whether or not this is happening. But now it seems that general consensus is that this is true. So I think this is absolutely fascinating. I'm really, really excited to talk about this. So the first question is, what are the issues with encoding something in a screenshot? I mean, you know, if the information was right there on the top left of the screen and you took a screenshot, then that information would be made public. To a certain extent, if the game is producing this image and then I'm uploading it, I think that's significantly less bad than secretly uploading my data to Blizzard, for instance. And I love how ballsy this is. People are saying that this is mainly to track down legal black World of Warcraft servers. And this is just a fabulous idea because it gives the IP address of the server they're connected to. I don't know to what extent Blizzard actually troll this data. They try and find it. But just the idea of them using this incredibly circuitous route to find out these black servers, just fantastic to me.
Yeah, it's certainly aligned with your creative approach to security. So I think that's an interesting aspect of this. I mean, you said it's kind of better than secretly uploading data to Blizzard. It's interesting because people are then unwittingly uploading personal data about other people. And to me, that's such a complex proposition that I'm not sure I can put my finger on whether that's better or worse. what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I was kind of coming at it from the direction that because you're making a specific action, you're uploading a screenshot, that kind of makes it different to it happening automatically. But of course, if it's unwitting, then maybe that's a completely different matter. I have sort of a lot of people on Rock Paper Shotgun saying that this is a non-story, that the idea of Blizzard sort of putting pretty innocuous kind of anti-piracy data in a screenshot is a non-story. I don't believe that at all. I don't agree. I think this is a fantastic story, and it's a massive story.
I totally agree, yeah.
I mean, it raises all sorts of interesting questions. Does Diablo 3 do this? Someone produced a brilliant piece of information, which is that it uses the encoding technique made by a company whose CEO was working at Blizzard from 2008 to 2011, which just makes it all the more exciting to me.
It's totally exciting. There's definitely a spy thriller in this. I think this ties into something you've been saying for a number of years, which is that you wanted more personal accountability for characters in MMOs. So you wanted to kind of maybe see people's real faces or, you know, have their real names tied to it so that it kind of, you know, well, you know, maybe not literally see their faces, but have some kind of personal link to them. And it's interesting that, you know, if you take a photo of someone in real life, that person is identifiable. And here they've just made it sort of more realistic to take a screenshot of someone because you can see, you know, exactly who their character is and exactly where they are.
Well, just so we're clear, it's only your character name and where you're attached to.
Yeah.
So it's not of like it's everyone someone else that you see in the game. Yeah. It's just your person.
Right.
The idea is I guess if you know people will be uploading screenshots of them playing on pirate servers. I love the idea because that's the first thing you do. You say, "Oh, I made my pirate server work. Look, this is me playing on my pirate server." And I love the idea of that specific action getting you in trouble. It's just so great.
That is great. I'm sorry that I slightly misunderstood that. I thought it was much more exciting than it actually was. So it's only the identity of the photographer. Well, then
that's right.
That's not quite as good. I wanted something that was, you know, magically capturing things in the scene, but I guess that's about 20 billion times harder to make work.
Yeah, and again, sort of more morally dubious.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear what they have to say about it. I'm surprised this story hasn't rolled downhill. Everyone loves giving Blizzard a hard time at the moment, and this seems like something which certain lefty hippie people would get extremely angry about. So again, I'm sort of surprised that this doesn't have any traction.
Here's something else that people might get unhappy about. Medal of Honor has some DLC based around the US incursion and killing of Bin Laden. Ian Hoddingham, are games feeding too much off real events?
I don't know. I mean, I kind of bring this up. This feels, to a certain extent, like a conversation we've had before. This seems like sort of Games Daily News circa 2007.
Yeah.
I think the idea of really directly modelling Bin Laden's hideout and taking the part of the troops is, though it taken to the nth degree and is a really fascinating idea. It's not something that's attractive to me, but I can imagine it being attractive to me, especially if I was younger or maybe a little bit more gung-ho. I quite like the idea of setting a different kind of game in Bin Laden's exact hideout, though. Like, I'd like to play Thief in a Bin Laden level. Something about that, like a combination of this is a place that existed and has vast resonance. A combination of that and the fact that it's a fantastical thing. That's really attractive to me.
I think we're going to tie that in at some point to when we talk about immersion and Dishonored later, because it's kind of similar, like the idea of place in game being really important. But yeah, the sort of the resonance that a real place has, but not necessarily that the resonance of those events, is certainly particularly interesting. I mean, just to go back and focus on the events for a second, this kind of thing has been happening a lot, and I think that it's just going to become culturally normative, so it's not going to be an issue anymore, because the developers of these games keep doing it. They keep using real situations, they keep using news. I mean, obviously there's the kind of how soon is too soon aspect, and this has been, you know, it's a long time since this happened, but it's interesting, and I think this is just going to become a way that we culturally process these kind of events.
Yeah, I suppose that in 10 years, a news story might be a level that we can play through, sort of a dramatization that happens very quickly. I have to say, personally, I'm far less interested in the idea of reenacting the mission which killed Bin Laden than I am of seeing how he was living. I really like the idea of finding out how many bathrooms he had. Like, that's actually really exciting to me as well. I know I'm old and a homeowner, I guess that's why. But I can imagine finding the size of his kitchen significantly more titillating than actually shooting him in the face, I have to say.
That, how the mighty have fallen. That's absolutely terrible. Jeff, in traditional form, thinks this is a bit too inflammatory. He says, too close to reality for me. 15 years ago, would we be mowing down senior IRA members?
Oh, wow.
That's pretty inflammatory. I don't know about this. Like, I just don't know about this controversial aspect of reenacting the killing of someone. I mean, I'm not entirely certain how far this DLC goes in terms of, like, does it have the Bin Laden character model that you're... that you're shooting
right
in the face?
I don't think anyone knows the answer to that yet. I mean, yeah, I'd love to play a Counter-Strike level based on this, and I'd love to play as Bin Laden, obviously.
Of course, with no weapon.
I mean, you know, you say too soon, but in 2005, I was genuinely shocked to hear a bunch of Italian kids on my tennis course singing a song that had the lyric, "I love Osama" in it. So, you know, I mean, it's difficult to say that kind of thing. I mean, in terms of mowing down the IRA, I think probably not, only because of the vast extent to which Americans romanticize them. So you're probably playing as the IRA mowing down English people.
Almost certainly. Yeah, it's difficult. I think I don't have a giant amount of moral concern over this. I mean, and I don't have any particular kind of, oh, think of the children, you know, argument for this, because kids are going to reenact stuff anyway, and etc. And reenactment is a kind of okay thing. But it certainly doesn't leave a good taste in the mouth. But then I think a lot of that kind of Andy McNab stuff, for me personally, doesn't leave a great taste in their mouth anyway. And it's certainly within that remit of like real conflict repackaged as entertainment, and then nothing's ever going to change that, frankly.
I mean, I think that the real key here, the only reason that things like this are offensive to me, and there's an absolutely amazing advert for Taco Bell or something that basically has like loads of dictators who have all died, and a kind of like, I'm next, and it was you know, really, really funny, but yeah, also kind of offensive. I think the reason it's offensive to me is very simply because someone is profiting. I have no problem with people making jokes about these things, but the fact is that Bin Laden is a free and very lucrative IP.
Yeah.
It's like using Sherlock Holmes. He doesn't have any copyright over him, and it's just that's what bothers me. I think that when you are really directly profiting over something which has caused pain to other people, that's just really complicated.
Yeah, absolutely, totally agree. More war now, and the developers of Arma 2 are now dealing with a controversy in which two of their number were arrested for spying by the Greek authorities when on holiday they took some photos of an Air Force base, despite, according to Eurogamer, having been warned not to do so by a fan in the days leading up to the events. So, Ian Hollingham, is this just another case of the real world and games colliding in a kind of awkward and difficult manner?
Yeah, I don't know who to be more dismissive of, the Greek government or these idiots. The Greek government do some fairly bad things. The last thing they did in association to video games was to ban them in public because they couldn't work out whether playing a Game Boy was gambling or not. And I think that that arresting a bunch of holidaymakers who were taking a picture of something which I presume wasn't all that far away from a random tourist route is a bit over the top as well. On the other hand, you know, if you take a picture of something which looks like a military installation, you can get arrested in America for that.
Yeah.
So I don't have an awful lot of sympathy for them either. I think this is a pretty good story. This almost sounds like a manufactured story. Like, if Arma 3 was about to come out, I could imagine seeing this as a manufactured headline.
Yeah, absolutely.
We want realism so much, we got arrested trying to take pictures of Greece.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of how I feel about this depends on the outcome for me. Like, being arrested for spying, for taking photos, is pretty controversial and difficult. And I think, you know, that's a lot down to the people on the ground who are like, oh no, these guys are taking photos, let's arrest them. And it's what happens then that's really important. And I think, you know, a lot of these stories where, certainly in the US, people have been arrested for photographing, you know, like a street sign or the outside of a building or, you know, just absolutely bananas things like that. And very rightly, the left wing on the internet and gets incredibly angry about that. I personally, this is one of the things where I agree with that political bent on it. Like, you have to be free to do normal things in public environments, like take pictures of official buildings without all this stuff, and you have to fight against this. This is different because it's a military installation and it's probably in quite a secluded area, and it's got more significance than that. So I agree there's a distinction there.
Yeah, I find taking pictures an interesting sort of right. I'm trying to work out whether I think it's a basic human right or not. Taking photographs can be used to defend an innocent person an awful lot.
Yep.
So I think that's pretty important. It can also be used to really sort of to hurt innocent people as well. So I just don't know. I mean, obviously, over-controlling governments are bad, and I think restricting sort of video and stuff tends to be a sign of over-restricted government. But I still kind of, I don't immediately know whether I think that being able to take photos of things is sort of an unalienable human right.
I think if something is in a public place, so if it's a building in a major city, in the centre of the city, that has an aesthetic impact on that city, I think it's kind of important to creatively that people are allowed to take photos of it in a way which is not sort of poking their camera through the window or trying to take pictures of people coming out or all of those things. And I don't think that it's, you know, someone might be challenged for doing that in a suspicious way. I think that's acceptable. And again, it's like how you handle that. But I just think, yes, my argument is kind of an aesthetic, artistic one, which is that if something is visible to the human eye, if I can go there and look at it and it's a public thing, then I should be allowed to take a photo of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that freedom of the press is sort of one of the most important things in my own personal moral code, and I think that sort of requires people to take pictures of, in some instances, can be a violation of privacy. Obviously, we're seeing like a massive fallout from the tabloids doing that in a completely unacceptable way. But sort of coming from a mass background, I always like to look at the edge cases. So what would be worse, you know, the press having no freedom to take pictures of people they think are doing something wrong, or the press having too much freedom? I think the worst thing is the press having no freedom. So I guess I go on the side of being able to take pictures. But you know, again, we hear all these horror stories about going to foreign countries and doing things which seem pretty normal to us and get you in real trouble. I mean, it's your responsibility when you go to a country to work out what the laws are. You can't go there and believe that just because you believe these rights are right, that they are the rights that you have in a different country.
Absolutely.
We
move from real places to fictional ones now, with Rock Paper Shotgun posting a trailer for the upcoming game, which we talk about every week, Dishonored. This time they're talking about the architecture, the aesthetic design, and the sense of immersion. So I wanted to ask you a general question. What do you think matters most for immersion in a game?
Yeah, this ties into something we were talking about last week, where we were saying that having games that are internally consistent, Minecraft being an uber example of that, where you can see how every single part of the architecture has been constructed, really works for immersion for me. So Spelunky is another good example. When you have a very tile-based game, there's something about that which makes the buildings created in that engine feel to me more real and more immersive. I haven't actually read this article or this video because I'm trying to hide myself as much as possible from the stuff they're putting out there because I want to play the game. I have to say, though, I don't have a lot of confidence in big AAA studios understanding immersion very well. I find immersion to involve sort of freedom of movement and, you know, no painted on doors and no invisible walls. You know, we're taking really creative approaches to make you believe that you are in a sort of a fully modeled space. One of the problems that I had with one of your favorite games, Bloodlines, is that the hub world didn't feel like a real place to me. It felt very much very artificial. And the same is true for Thief 3's hub world, which is disappointing because Thief 1 and 2 really sold themselves on how amazingly immersive and coherent each level was. So though, you know, whatever they think, that's interesting. But I do have a suspicion that Dishonored will fail in areas that I think are important for immersion.
Yeah, sure, that's a very good suspicion, I think. I mean, this discussion was mostly about how they started off with a 17th century view of London as the aesthetic. And then what happened was that as the artists got going, they found that they wanted to incorporate some slightly anachronistic elements, and that led to something more fantastical. And the aesthetic they have is very original. And this video really shows how they've managed to create something that I think is really quite exciting. Like, it's not based on any particular lore or fiction that's been pre-existing. They said that they try to avoid things like Google image search, like the specific way that you do references for games. They try to take a much more free-form approach to try and use their imagination a bit more. So I really appreciate that. But in terms of how that ties into immersion, I think what you're talking about is also incredibly important, which is how are you actually interacting with this landscape? It's all very well having all this cool stuff everywhere and a cool setting, but unless you can go to the places that are being depicted, then it's not going to work.
Yeah, exactly. I really like the idea of not using Google image search. You know, whenever you can try and sort of use a new technique to really set yourself apart, I think that's just a really, really good idea. I mean, and again, it depends how you can interact with the environment. One of the problems that a lot of these games have is they don't really let you climb over a lot of the things. Like, one of the great things about Thief was it was quite blocky and you could use rope arrows and stuff, and really like felt that if you could see it, you kind of move there. And that's something that I felt that was existing in, say, Half-Life 1 and not necessarily Half-Life 2. Yeah. As these games like get more uber like prettily modeled, they have to sort of close off some spaces to be specifically not for walking, because, you know, it doesn't make sense with the game's physics, the game's movement, the way those mechanics work. So I think that's important as well. Like, if you have, I'm looking at this screenshot at the top of this article, and I'm looking at it, and again, I'm thinking that looks like a corridor with a pretty sort of thing around it. So it's an interesting picture to choose. Yeah, again, I think for me it is, like you say, how you interact with the space.
Yeah, well, we're definitely going to see exactly how freeform the missions are and exactly how much of that scope they do have in there. There has been some talk about, you know, a very Deus Ex-like kind of approaching missions the way you want sort of thing. But yeah, I don't know how many fake doors there are going to be in this game. So we'll have to wait and see. Another thing that we don't have to wait for much longer is Little Big Planet Vita, and reviews have come out saying that it's amazing, fantastic, and based on the people that we know who have been working on that game, we could probably have predicted that, so that's pretty cool. I want to talk a little bit about your expectations for this game, because it's kind of been the key thing you've been waiting for on the Vita, and also a little bit about how the Vita is for you in general.
Yeah, Register City Rampage is actually probably the key thing I'm waiting for.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But I'm definitely going to buy this on day of release. I'm really keenly aware that an awful lot of people, and I think, you know, a lot of people think there haven't been enough like really quality first party titles yet.
Yeah.
And I can definitely understand that. And I think it's really important to get this one out there. This is obviously the Mario of yeah. Sony's platform, so it's great to get it out there. I do actually want to talk a little bit because Siron, who's a great member of our community, was a bit dismissive of the Vita on Twitter the other day, saying that, you know, if I'm at home, I use a PC, and if I'm away, it's like I'm not going to have it with me. You know, I'm going to be playing on my phone. You know, I understand that, but I have to say, if I'm at home, I want to be playing on the Vita.
Yeah.
I really, really, really enjoy watching TV with my wife and playing like proper cool games on the Vita. I really love having a proper control system. I don't really like playing traditional games on my iPhone or my iPad. So I mean, people could sort of accuse us of being partisan, but I'm not partisan. I just absolutely love the Vita. I think it's an amazing platform. I'm really glad it exists.
I think what's good and what people may not know, although it has been announced publicly, is that Sony are saying, wait, like the lineup is coming, a lot of stuff is about to drop. And I think Little Big Planet has been the thing they've been waiting for. They want to give it its own space. They want to, you know, it's going to bring a huge new user base to the Vita. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a big spike in Vita sales just because of this. I'm sure they're going to be bundling
definitely
it.
Will be.
And then it's going to be time to unleash the torrent of great stuff that they have. And they have such a good back catalogue. I mean, they've been releasing a lot of PS1 games. I know that some people feel quite strongly that there aren't that many good PS1 games, but they've been releasing, you know, a huge amount of those, so you can really make your own choices now. I'm waiting for some of the older, you know, classic stuff to come out as well. For me, the Vita's kind of got everything in terms of, yeah, controls, and it's something that I want to use as a portable device and at home. And what I really want to see is it get more support, and I think this is going to do it. I'm going to be buying this game, and I previously have not been a Little Big Planet fan, but I really want something interesting like this to play on my Vita, and so many people have been saying, you know, oh, you need to try out all the different user levels, and it's just a really nice experience to see all the weird stuff that people make, and it's kind of worth it for that alone. So, and I think I'd probably be able to get over my problems with the controls a little bit more in the Vita, just because I like using it so much. So I'm excited.
Yeah,
for it.
I really liked. I ended up really liking Little Big Planet 1. I'm gonna get in such trouble for saying this. I like the community. The community content stuff just it doesn't work for me very specifically. Like I don't want to create stuff in an engine like that. I spend all my day creating game content, so it's not relaxing for me.
Yeah.
And I like to have really curated stuff. Like I feel not confident when I go online that I'm going to get a level that's really worth playing. I really want curated stuff. So yeah. That's just me. You know, so I mean, that entire side of it, sorry, go on.
I think that with this, though, the idea is that they've got this blend of, like, there is a good amount of curated stuff, and the reason that I want the user stuff is just for pure entertainment, for comedy. Like, I want to see
I want to be giggling. I know you are. But what I was saying was that, you know, with that massive side of LBP1 just not working for me, I still really enjoyed it. It was a really, really, really inventive platform game. And again, it's like what we were talking about earlier. They had a really consistent internal system, and then they got a load of really talented people to work what they could do with it. Those are always the best games. When you at some point close off the tool set and say, okay, now you have to make this interesting, like you have to do something really weird with this.
Yeah.
And the single player was really good, so I'm totally into it. I also can't wait for Super Crate Box to come out.
Yes.
The PlayStation, I think it's branded PlayStation Mobile stuff, which is basically kind of a runtime environment that will run on PS3, Vita, their future consoles, and some of their tablets and stuff. And that's what Super Crate Box is being developed under. That's like a really interesting idea. Like, I think they're trying to find a way of sort of crossing between their like standard stuff and like App Store kind of stuff. And I like the idea of having this runtime, if it's fast enough, that allows them to port it to everything straight away. So again, people could accuse me of being partisan, but I actually just awfully like a lot of the decisions that Sony are making right now.
Good stuff. Borderlands 2 has a live-action TV and online advert. I think everyone's kind of seen this right now. And I was at my parents' house, and this came on. And my dad worked in marketing for quite a number of years. So I was like, Dad, look at this marketing. This game has the most original, unique aesthetic that they spent millions of dollars on, all this promo art, and they decide to go with something that looks like a trauma movie with guys in yellow trousers just firing Nerf guns at each other, diving behind plastic rocks. Ian Hollingham, what is this? Why is this?
I found this completely bizarre. I was happily drinking a lot of beer and watching American football with my friends, yourself included, and this came on, and I was just, what? I mean, I was quite drunk at the time. It took me a little while to realize that it was live action, because they're really trying hard to make it look like the game. So I do ask them, well, why on earth didn't you do it in-game rather than having all these actors do it? I feel really old and curmudgeonly about this. I think it's stupid.
I don't understand why. It's too expensive. And the game looks great, and everyone loves the game. And
I'm going to buy that game release. I'm super excited for Borderlands 2.
Exactly. A lot of people like it. I think I'm even going to give it another go, even though I was grouchy and miserable about Borderlands 1 for some reason. It's just like, that's all I want to say. Finally, we're going to close with some retro gaming now. Eurogamer has a pretty nice piece. I'm enjoying these exploratory Eurogamer pieces. They're good. It's called The Fraud of Retro Gaming, Crippled by Nostalgia. And my question is retro gaming purely nostalgia-based, or are there genuinely good experiences to be gained by playing older games?
Yeah, this sounds like an A-level essay question, I have to say.
Totally.
I mean, because both things are obviously true. I mean, nostalgia is an incredibly powerful force. And, you know, if I ever play Super Mario World, I am overcome with rose-colored glasses. Just absolutely love it, you know. But on the other hand, Mario World is probably the best Mario game. So I pretty much just put Super Mario World as the start and the end of this argument. The person who wrote this article really went into depth about collecting games, which seemed... I actually thought this article wasn't great, to be honest, and it seemed a bit sort of tertiary to the whole thing, because there's also the thing about collectors don't tend to play the games that they're collecting, you know, a very small percentage of them. The activity of collecting and consuming are two completely different things, but again, that's like a different A-level question. So
I've been thinking about buying a SNES recently, and just for solely for the reason that I like older hardware just as aesthetic stuff. I think it's interesting.
And yeah,
I didn't really play any SNES games at all because I was a Mega Drive kid. And there's quite a few things on there that I was thinking about getting. And I have a lot of emulated stuff. And I just thought, you know, what's the experience now of going and buying a retro console? Because I bought a few things, you know, when I was at university and tried it out, and it was pretty cheap. And I found that, like, SNESs and games on eBay now are pretty expensive. Like, it's going to cost you 60, 70 quid to get a working SNES with games. And that's a lot. You can buy a lot of retro game collection type stuff for that. So it kind of, that level of money, I don't know why it was that specifically, just put me off, because I was expecting, like, 20, 30 quid. So maybe demand for this stuff is going up now.
Yeah, maybe the SNES is, like, really at its sweet, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, you know, emulation is another area that's a little bit like piracy. I certainly don't feel as bad about occasionally sort of emulating a game, certainly one that I can't buy on any existing platform. I think that's sort of my personal moral line with that kind of thing. If I really can't buy it, then I don't really mind sort of downloading it to have a go at it. I've still got like a Dreamcast. I've got my N64 and my N64 DD. There's so much of a faff to plug in. Again, that's sort of part of it. The key to these things is that sort of some games hold up, some games don't. For instance, I think that the sequel to Super Mario World, Yoshi's Island, I don't think that holds up sort of quite as well, that kind of thing. I'm not really a collector. If I want to play these things, I actually want to play on the Vita, which won't be allowed, you know, but maybe a sort of a GP2X or something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if an emulation solution, which is, you know, paid and legal, is good, then I'm definitely up for purchasing that. And Sega have been, like, the leaders in that, really getting their stuff onto loads of platforms, which is fantastic. People were saying they should have done that for years, and they did listen and actually do it. And I bet that makes them a good chunk of money now, all of those Steam collections and so on. So it's pretty interesting. I mean, the final aspect of this, I guess, is the history of games and those kind of, you know, when you play emulated stuff, you're really losing a lot of the experience, especially with original controllers probably being the most direct and big one. Do you think there's anything really being lost there, or do people just need to get over that?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think the controller is massively important. I really like having converters for old gaming controllers. I have an N64 controller converter that I got from Lixang about 12 years ago, and I once played Tribes 2 with it, and that was really stupid. But, you know, yeah, the controllers, I think, are probably my favorite thing about old consoles. They're so interesting. They have real nostalgia, and they're mainly pretty good, and they're often quite original. You know, so I'm really into that. I think the Xbox pad is a pretty good, like, final evolution of that kind of joypad, but I still like playing on the N64 one more.
Yeah. Ding. That's the end of the main body of the show, and now into the filthy and suspicious antechamber of its conclusion. And I have a few different things to talk about, which I'm going to spring on you like a terrible spring. Well, I want to talk about football first, because we had a good first night of football, and we were using NFL Game Pass, which you've used for a number of years, and I've only just experienced, which allows you to watch NFL games on your computer in the UK. And I have to say, I'm very impressed with this service, and I think it would be good if anyone's sort of thinking of dipping their toe into watching NFL games, that they should pick this up. I want to recommend that to people.
Absolutely. It's 100 quid for the whole season, which is pretty amazing, in my opinion, because that's an awful lot of content, kids. The only sort of real limitation is that there's one game at 6 p.m. on a Sunday and one game at 9 p.m. on a Sunday that you can't watch live. But there are other games at those times all of the time. They don't show the Sky game at the same time as Sky, which is fair enough. It's just a great service. Like, if you've got any interest in it. I think you might be able to pay for 1 month as well, which is even cheaper. You can get a version which only shows your favorite team, which I actually don't recommend. I think one of the real joys of the NFL is seeing a lot of different games. I think that's probably the most unique thing about the league itself, is that most NFL games are actually interesting from kind of some kind of perspective. But we're big into football here, and I have like the Sky on one input to the TV and the Game Pass on another, and you can just flip through them. It's really easy, it's really nice, and it's really fun.
It works well. At the risk of alienating our sports hating segment, do you have any impressions from week one that you want to share?
I'm glad the Saints suck. I'm a Falcons fan. No, I don't have anything particularly. I lost at fantasy last week. Fantasy football is an interesting game. I'm afraid I don't have anything particularly useful.
That'll do. Andy Murray, of course, winning a major to continue the sports phenomenon.
We're hemorrhaging listeners.
We lost one. We lost one with the football, I can see in real time. But I want to talk about Andy Murray. What do you think? Is this the peak of his career? Is he?
No, I don't think that. You and me are really, really feel differently about Andy Murray. I think he's great. I think there's absolutely no way that it's Apex. I'm on the record as saying 2 months ago that I think he will be number one in the world for a period of time, and I absolutely stand by that. He's currently number three. He's taken over Nadal, which is mainly due to Nadal's injuries. But I think I watched the first two sets. I think that Djokovic is massively overrated because he had an incredibly good year. Yep. I think that people put Djokovic in the same tier as Nadal and Federer, which I think is just wrong. Historically speaking, I think that Murray is certainly in the same tier as Djokovic right now, and he's beaten him twice in a row, so fair enough. It was a really, really great first set. The rest of the match wasn't as great. The first set tiebreak was pretty amazing. I'm just quite a big Murray fan.
There you go. I think it's going to be interesting. I think that he has been a bit lucky in terms of timing his best play, because nobody is arguing, you know, that he's not significantly better than he was before. He's timed that with a period where Federer is basically done, Nadal is basically crippled, and Djokovic is basically terrible. And I think, you know, that reflects pretty well on him, to be honest.
That is, I couldn't disagree more with that. The first thing is, it's difficult to argue that he's lucky playing now. This is probably one of the most competitive eras of men's tennis ever, so it's really hard to say that he's lucky. Like, even, you know, even notwithstanding the fact that Nadal is injured, I think he is lucky that Nadal's injured, because I think Nadal is his worst matchup. Traditionally, I think that's true. I think saying that Federer is done is I just don't agree with that. I mean, he was pretty amazing at Wimbledon. He you know, he didn't have a good performance in the Wimbledon, but, you know, and Djokovic, while not quite to the insane level as last year, is still pretty high. So I'm sorry, man, we just disagree about Murray.
I think I was being massively inflammatory there. I think, honestly, like, Federer's probably got a second or like an 18th wind left in him, and he's going to come back. Nadal, I have no idea. Like, I don't think anyone does. I haven't heard a pundit make an authoritative statement about Nadal for about a year and a half. So it'll be certainly
so young. I mean, he'll absolutely have, like, we were talking about it at football, actually. We were sort of trying to set the over-under for how many more major wins Nadal has. And I think the over-under is probably 3.5, you know, and that's pretty big. So I think he'll definitely be relevant significantly for the next 5 years.
Right, that's the end of Sporting Sunday with Paul and Ian. I want to, back to our target demographic, I want to drop a quick movie review. I saw Dread in the cinema where there were four people, one of whom was me. And it was, like I've been saying today, it was a bit like the pilot of a TV show. The structure was really weird. It's just kind of a really long action sequence with quiet bits in the middle and then some sort of fairly ominous dialogue. He's definitely adopted the kind of Tom Hardy school of monotonous responses. It's very much like the comic. Like, Dredd hardly ever says anything other than one-liners. And yes, right. And no, and incendiary. And it's just completely mental. So if that sounds like you would like that, then you should watch it. But it's certainly not a good movie. And written by Alex Garland as well, who's written a completely bizarre and random selection of different things. So that's my movie review of Dread.
Yeah, probably going to try and see that. I will have suitably low expectations.
That's fine. Right, thank you very much for listening and watching. If you're watching later,
do we not
on YouTube,
have any reader questions or anything?
Well, we could do some reader questions, but I think we've outstayed our welcome with the sports and movies. Does anyone in the chat have anything that they want to contribute?
I think we should always do reader questions. I always enjoy hearing from our crazy crowds.
Well, that's fine, but it depends on, you know, we lost three people with the sports.
Oh, no.
Section. So we need to, I have to drop the mention in earlier in order to get stuff in time for this segment. If you have anything you wish us to discuss, please speak now. Other than that, if you don't,
or forever be silent,
please like the video on YouTube and share it around. We have a new iTunes link now to replace the older iTunes link, so I shall be posting details about that. Do subscribe on iTunes. The blog is visitingthevillage.com. And in the absence of any contributions from the chat, who are being tardy with their vocalization, the only question seems to be no StarCraft today, which is actually true. We almost managed to get through an entire show without StarCraft. Where is the real Paul will be back next week. I'm playing a little bit more actually at the moment, so maybe I can report back on my ladder failings. But that's enough from us. It's enough from me and it's enough from him. Goodbye.
Bye.
That's it, children. Time for bed. Don't forget to pay us a visit at www.visitingthevillage.com.